Film Spotting is presented by PeerFlix. Trade DVDs online at peerflix.com/filmspotting.
What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Well, look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Sam Van Halkren.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. Happy Thanksgiving weekend, everyone. Coming up on tonight's show, Fun with Franchises, a review of Fast Food Nation, and a conversation with the film's director and co-writer, Richard Linklater.
Plus, a look at the latest James Bond reboot, Casino Royale, Massacre Theater, music from Chuck Prophet, and in honor of 007, our top five adrenaline rushes, movie scenes that get our blood pumping. But Adam, let's place Bond under the warmer and discuss Fast Food Nation.
They got a hold of a couple of big ones. Frozen patties, don't ask me how. And the fecal coliform counts were just off the charts. I'm concerned that this could be a problem for us. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Not exactly.
I'm saying there's in the meat.
Hardcore investigative journalism fans may be disappointed to find that the film version of Eric Schlosser's 2001 best-selling book, Fast Food Nation, a movie co-written by Schlosser and director Richard Linklater, isn't so much a muckraking expose of American greed and excess as it is a Richard Linklater movie. Like Linklater's talky debut film Slacker, which follows its ensemble cast through a meandering day in Austin, Texas, Fast Food Nation is centered around the fictional Colorado town of Cody, home of the packing plant that supplies all of the meat for the popular Mickey's hamburger franchise. In one narrative thread, we meet a group of illegal Mexican immigrants who go to work at the plant with visions of a better life. Another involves a Mickey's marketing exec, played by Greg Kinnear, who is dispatched to Cody to find out why there is so much crap in the meat, literally. There's also, among numerous other characters, a bright, idealistic high school student named Amber who works at Mickey's. Sam, despite numerous differences, namely in tone, scale, and pretty much every single thing about the way the two films are shot, I couldn't help but compare Fast Food Nation to another current release with multiple interconnected narratives and political motivations, Babel, which I found to be technically brilliant but manipulative, contrived, and perhaps even a bit sadistic. You, meanwhile, were moved by its epic tale of global disconnection. No, I have no idea what that actually means, but my question for you is, did Fast Food Nation make a similar impression?
Well, it's interesting because, yes, we completely disagreed on Babel, and yet this film is different in a number of ways I think we'll get to, but I like this one too.
Okay.
And I think if we're going to compare the two, and again, it's probably unfair to compare the two thematically, I think they're much different, of course. As you said, Inarritu's Babel is about global disconnections, about the lack of communication, the sort of global consequences of that. And this film is, no, it's not a muckraking expose, as you say, but it certainly is very critical of a very specific industry, the meatpacking industry, and gives us an insight, unless you've already read the book, to a world we probably would not have explored on our own otherwise. It's really not good news. But what I was thinking about in terms of what Linklater does so well with his films, the kind of sleight of hand that he uses so well as a writer and director, is it's about how people talk to each other.
Mm-hmm.
That's how he creates his reality. You look at Inarritu, and it's all about how people behave.
Sure.
And that's how he creates his reality. And really, you know, Linklater is not a visual stylist at all. He really just puts the camera up there, and really he tries to create the illusion that these are people behaving and living real lives strictly with his dialogue. And you see it from the very beginning of his career. You mentioned Slacker. It's ingenious the way he does it.
Yeah.
And it's almost like he's willing to be boring in order to convince you to understand this world and these people in it. But what I loved about this film, apart from the dialogue and the characters that he creates and really brings to life from this nonfiction book, is that it's the perfect kind of political movie, I think, because he creates characters that aren't perfect people. There are no perfect villains. There are no perfect angels. There are people that are more or less in the category of villain. We have a villain, yes, played by Bobby Cannavale, who works in the meatpacking industry. And we have, like you said, this young idealistic girl, Amber, played by Ashley Johnson, very much an angel, if you will, in terms of her ideals. But I loved the fact that he doesn't go out of his way to villainize anybody, particularly, and we sort of start the story with Greg Kinnear's character, like you said, this marketing exec who works for Mickey's. And I love the way it introduces him as a very good, responsible parent, while not making him some kind of great hero, just a normal guy who's just trying to make a living as he sort of uncovers the horrors of the industry he's just started working with. And then when it goes, you know, when it introduces the illegal immigrants that make up the working force in Cody at this meatpacking plant, these are just people. These are not simply victims of the trade. And you have characters that are not sympathetic, and yet we have this wonderful scene with Bruce Willis, who plays a liaison between the meatpacking plant and Mickey's, who, you know, may have some his morals as far as his industry goes may be a little loose, but he's the one character that actually really celebrates these immigrants that reinvigorate the notion of what it is to be an American. Everybody has these wonderful contradictions. And some of the most inspiring stuff as far as, like, are we going to do something about this, come from these people we can't entirely sympathize with. Oh, they're kind of silly characters. And these words of wisdom are coming from their mouth right after they say something maybe that you find completely ridiculous. I really found it a really incredible achievement.
You have no idea how relieved I am to hear you say this, Sam, because I loved this movie. In fact, it was one of my favorite movies of the year. It is one of my favorite movies of the year so far. And I set up this idea of this comparison to Babel, and I don't want to use this as an opportunity to tear down Babel. We've had our review. You can go to our website and listen to that review if you're curious, but it will help me a little bit explain why I like this movie so much. And you actually highlighted some of the things, but I talked about how the characters in Babel to me seemed like types, and they were kind of pawns in R2 and Arriaga's larger game. And it wasn't until after we reviewed the movie that I was able to for me to really articulate what I was trying to say, what I actually meant by it. And the problem with Babel is that I feel like I knew everything I needed to know about the characters in Babel within a minute of them being on screen. I knew where their story arc was going. I knew how they'd react in certain situations. It all, to me, seemed programmed. Even their epiphanies by the end aren't surprising. What they learn about themselves isn't really provocative or a shock at all. You watch Fast Food Nation, or at least when I watched Fast Food Nation, I never felt like I had these characters pegged. I was constantly surprised by them. I learned something about the characters in every scene, every time they open their mouths. And you mentioned Greg Kinnear, who plays this marketing executive. And he is a great example of someone who could have been so easily a stereotypical figure, this representative of the evil Mickey's marketing, you know, fast food
franchise.
Clearly a
stand-in for McDonald's.
Exactly.
Right.
And you're right. He's just a normal guy looking for answers. And I thought that was fascinating. And, you know, I think that, as you said, Linklater doesn't have the visual chops that Naruto does, but he clearly doesn't care. And in the end, for me, it ends up being a lot less pretentious and a lot more profound, because he's not really bludgeoning you with his philosophy. He is just letting these characters exist and be who they are. And that's why I think that I'm shocked a little bit when I've seen a few comments from some critics. And I remember reading one I mentioned to you a while back. I think it was Glenn Kenny in Premiere.
Yeah.
He wrote about it from Toronto, and we were so far away from the movie at the time that I read what he had to say. And he hated the film. And if I recall, he hated it because he thought it was too preachy. And it's funny, because despite the fact that this movie could so easily be preachy, all these things it's about, dealing with meat packing and, you know, all the bad stuff that's in the meat and these characters, how they're abused and all that stuff, I never felt like the characters were mouthpieces for Linklater or Schlosser. And this is something I actually asked Linklater about. We'll hear his answer in our interview in the next segment. But I think every character talks and says exactly what you believe those characters in that environment would say. And I think that, you know, for example, there's a scene where these college students are talking in this environmental club, and they have some lines that could be really kind of funny and could come off as being really preachy in a way. But you can't really mock them or mock Linklater and Schlosser, because I think the kids talk exactly how you'd expect those kids do. Their opinions aren't perfectly formed. They're looking for answers. They're thinking out loud. The movie has that sense of these characters thinking out loud, being believable and real the entire time. I really did love this film.
Yeah, I agree. And like I said, the film, I think, takes a bit of time in a way where if Linklater does risk a letting his characters or his story be a little dry, a little boring, everything sort of clicked to me in terms of the moral clarity of what he was getting at. I mean, talk about the perfect casting of this film. I think the movie really clicked in. And again, I was really enjoying, and again, the first part of this film is Greg Kinnear's character sort of coming to these realizations, as we are, about the industry. But then we're introduced to Kris Kristofferson's character, this rancher who had had experience working with the meatpacking industry, lives out in Cody, and he gives us the first real piece. I mean, a lot of these things are scripted in a way where you can see where he's taken stuff straight out of the book.
Yeah.
But there was something about you're casting the most authentic man,
rugged Coloradoan,
Coloradan, who exists in the person of Kris Kristofferson,
right.
And what he has to say all of a sudden gives everything this moral clarity and focus, and really frames the rest of the film, I think. And then again, I mentioned Bruce Willis, but he has just this amazing single.
It's a great
scene, and he's such an interesting character, and he has one scene because really he's defending corporate culture in a way that you can sympathize with absolutely.
Yeah.
And then at the same time, he says something that nobody else does in terms of defending.
It's a brilliant scene. Yeah, it's a brilliant scene because he's hilarious in it. He really is.
Yeah.
But it perfectly sums up what I'm saying about the film. I think not being too preachy and not being predictable in its characters, because you see Bruce Willis and you hear the things he's saying and the way he's saying it. You've made up your mind about him. And then it ends up being so surprising and I think layered. And it makes you realize that I haven't read Fast Food Nation yet, the book. But apparently at the end when he says what you can do to help solve this problem of kind of the fast food sprawl and everything else, he says, you can, you know, the next time you want to buy fast food, don't buy it. Simply don't go into the restaurant. Well, despite the fact that Schlosser says that, when you're watching this film, you hear Bruce Willis give the other side of the argument while at once also proving the argument. He also gives you the counterpoint, and he says, you know, he makes me realize that you're not necessarily helping these people who are suffering in these plants by reducing the demand for the product they're helping to make. And so all of a sudden, everything you think you know about a character, and you know you know that these are evil people running this plant and running Mickey's, all of a sudden you hear his speech and you go, wow, this is way more complicated than I wanted to believe it is.
And the film isn't about making you as the viewer feel like you're better or smarter than anybody in this industry. It really indicts you without being heavy-handed or preachy about it. It's just like, you are a consumer.
Right.
How do you behave as a consumer? And I think it's the kind of film that brilliantly allows you to have a conversation, a dialogue, without telling you how you should think.
Mm-hmm. No, you're exactly right. And I think that one way that he gets at this, again, a touch that I just absolutely loved in this film that I think is really bold on Linklater's part, and Schlosser as the co-screenwriter, is they have, I don't think we're giving anything away to say, that at some point in the film, with still about 30 or 40 minutes left, Greg Kinnear's character, who's kind of been our guide, and I ask Linklater about this, he's kind of been our guide, all of a sudden, he disappears. He literally checks out of his hotel and is gone from the movie. And I've seen a few critics kind of chalk this up to just Linklater being clumsy with the script and the structure, but there's something so perfect, I think, again, about a character in this interconnected story who, once his storyline is through,
we've seen
his arc's over.
Absolutely.
He actually just gets up and leaves. There's no point in beating it. It perfectly ends. More importantly, there's a political angle to it that Linklater discusses a little bit, where it does put the onus, as you said, back on the audience. Greg Kinnear is not going to be Aaron Brockovich. He's not going to make you feel comfortable that he's out there crusading for you and is going to solve your problems. We have to do it for ourselves. And I just want to close, Sam, by saying, I don't know about you, and I know how ridiculous and maybe corny this could sound, but I had a reaction to this film where it did make me walk out of the film completely inspiring me to want to do something. And all I can say is to want to do something to make the world a better place.
I think it just,
I don't necessarily want to bring down the fast food industry. I don't know that me not going to McDonald's is going to solve any of these problems, but I know that I want to do something, because there is this great dialogue about these characters either kind of sitting on their butts or doing something to bring about change. And I found myself getting very caught up in that, and I know that I want to do something, honestly, and I haven't figured it out yet, but
totally
the movie inspired me.
I totally agree, and I think all it does, and this is what's great about it, is that it just reminds you that you do have choices, that you can do something, and it doesn't tell you any more than that.
That's true. Perfectly said.
All right, well, if you've seen Fast Food Nation and agree or disagree with our takes, please email us at feedback@filmspotting.net. We may not get a chance to respond, but we will definitely read your email.
After the break, I trick Fast Food Nation director Richard Linklater into actually saying something bad about Austin, Texas. And stick around for our review of Casino Royale and our top 5 adrenaline rushes. Back in a moment.
I walk 20 blocks to your favorite bakery to pick you up a little treat. I know you're not the riser after a long night on your feet, and this pretty flower's called a Saint Carlina. It's grown in the African wild. Oh, baby, just to see you smile.
Welcome back to Film Spotting on Chicago Public Radio with Sam Van Hallgren. I'm Adam Kempinar. You can listen to Film Spotting the last Saturday of every month right here on Chicago Public Radio. Or if you like what you hear and you want to subscribe to our weekly podcast, just go to filmspotting.net.
Adam, we just reviewed Fast Food Nation.
Yes.
Both.
Very,
liked it a lot.
We both liked it. Very spirited
after
conversation.
After our heated disagreement about Babel just a week before.
That's right. We're now in harmony.
In harmony.
The world
again.
Is in harmony.
And we're
it's,
going to
it's
change
nice.
The world.
And actually, I think the show's over because I'm running out to join Greenpeace.
That's right. It sounds
so,
like
or
Save
the Peace
the
Corps. I haven't decided yet, but anyway.
That's right. Well, earlier this week, you had a chance to speak with Fast Food Nation's director, Richard Linklater. Let's hear your conversation.
Before we get into Fast Food Nation, I have to ask you about Austin, Texas, because this is a place where Quentin Tarantino is hanging out all the time now. Robert Rodriguez is there. You're there. All I hear about is how great Austin, Texas is, and I've never been there. I want you to tell me something that sucks about Austin. It can't be perfect.
Well, we say the only thing that sucks about Austin is it's surrounded by Texas.
Well, fair enough.
That's kind of a joke. I love Texas as a lifetime Texan, but
yeah.
Something kind of nice about, Austin in the middle of it. You know?
Mm-hmm. Well, Fast Food Nation is based on Eric Schlosser's 2001 nonfiction book. This is the first time he's been involved with a movie, as far as I can tell. How did you guys come together, and how did the collaboration on the script work?
Yeah, well, I read the book, I think, when it came out in paperback, and I was fortunate enough to meet Eric when he came through Austin, and we started talking about it as a movie. You know, I didn't really see it at first, but then he mentioned it potentially as a fictional film that just centered around a town and the lives of these workers who find themselves at different points in the fast food industry. And that's what really got me going. I've been trying to make this movie in a way from that worker perspective, you know, for a long time. And it was a subject I cared, you know, about a lot. So it just sort of, we started with the characters and it just seemed like an interesting way to tell this story. I mean, there's a lot of nonfiction information out there.
Mm-hmm.
Eric's book being, you know, the best example, but, you know, there's a ton of stuff out there for those interested in the subjects that this, you know, this film covers. But it was kind of fun to throw a fictional representation in there as well.
It's interesting that he was the one who kind of had the idea for the fictional film, and you said it started with the characters. I'm curious if there was one character in particular it started with.
No, I don't think it was one. We always saw it from multiple perspectives. It's a good way to tell a story, especially something so vast as this. But I think the three workers who come across the desert from Mexico, they were always there. And I think the teenage girl who works there, she was always there. And, you know, pretty much what was there was that was always going to be the spine of it.
How was working with the guy who is responsible for the source material different than other collaborations you may have worked on?
Well, in this case, it was essential. I mean, Eric was kind of open for if I wanted to go off on my own and make it, he'd be cool with it. You know, I think he trusted me as a filmmaker, but I kind of insisted he'd be there every step of the way because he was the conduit to so much of that, those people, the information, just the whole vibe of the book. I wanted him there. And, you know, Eric, you know, I mean, he started as a playwright. He's written plays. Some screenplays and stuff, so he's a natural dramatist. So it was a wonderful collaboration.
Well, as you said a little bit, the book is different in that it focuses really on this entire industry and that information is kind of out there, and this is really a fictional film about, really, isn't it, about the American dream? You have a lot of characters here with big aspirations or characters that are trying to do good who, for lack of a better phrase, really get kind of chewed up by the system.
Yeah, when we say Fast Food Nation, it's not really just about the food. You know, it's about this kind of corporate bottom-line mentality that often leaves people out of its quotient, you know, of quarterly profitability. You realize there's not a lot of, they don't think there's no humanity in that equation quite often. So it's these people who do start off with these hopes and aspirations, but, you know, we don't see how vulnerable we really are in this system.
Look, I don't waste a lot of time thinking about this stuff.
No.
Democrats, Republicans, they're all crooks.
This is why revolutions are meant for the young. If you don't do it now, you're never gonna. Uniform, uniformity. Conform, conformity. Monogamy, monotony.
No wonder you're not still married.
Hey.
Stupid stupidity.
Yeah, look, hey, the facts are not always friendly.
I love the fact, one of the things I really enjoyed about the film is that Greg Kinnear's character, this executive for Mickey's, the fast food company in the film, he's kind of our conscience, and he's kind of the guy who is, you know, our guide through this world. And then at one point, he checks out of his hotel, and he really checks out of the film at that point. I really like that. Can you talk about that decision?
Yeah, that's pretty radical in script 101 form. You know, you're not supposed to have your lead character walk out of the movie halfway through. But it's very intentionally positioned that way because he's had his opportunity to be a hero. He could have been Norma Rae. He could have been that movie we've all seen that he organizes. He comes in and rights all the wrongs and sets things correctly. But that would have been really untruthful. You know, this is such a big world. You know, this industry, it's so vast. There's so many moving parts to it that, you know, no one person is going to, you know, do all that. And, you know, he's not a bad guy. He's just doing what he thinks is best for himself, his family. You know, someone said worse than bad guys doing bad things, the real tragedy of life is good guys doing bad things.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think that's kind of apt here.
Yeah.
You know, you have a lot of well-meaning, not bad people operating in a system that's really unhealthy for all of us. So it was kind of fun to depict that because he represents all of us. By doing that, it sort of puts it back on the audience,
mm-hmm,
as citizens, you know, to think about these issues and realize it's up to all of us, you know, at a consumer level, at a consciousness level, to make our decisions and make things better. It's sort of like global warming. You know, you walk out of Al Gore's film and you don't go, hey, well, I'm glad Al's got it all taken care of. You walk out going, God, you know, I do actually have a little part to play in all this. We all do.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
You're listening to Film Spotting. My guest is Richard Linklater. His latest film is Fast Food Nation. And there is a quote I thought of, actually, from Roger Ebert's review, believe it or not, of the movie Wild Things. I thought of during your movie watching it the other night, because there's a line where he is reviewing the film and he mentions the kind of famous sex scene in that film, and he says that it's either gratuitous or indispensable, depending on your point of view. And you get to the end of this film where we finally get taken inside the kill room of this meatpacking plant. And really, the film, I think, on some level has been building to this, but how did you approach that and that decision to take us inside and show us that?
Yeah, I mean, this whole movie to us was about getting at the truth behind this industry, and that is the ultimate truth that's kept hidden from all of us. You know, so, I mean, it's not like on some unconscious level we know it goes on rationally. This goes on. This is whatever your meat you're eating, whether it's pigs, chickens, cows, you know, they have to get slaughtered at some point. So, but when you just buy a shrink-wrapped package or something in a styrofoam container, you know, it's pretty easy to be pretty disconnected from that fact.
Mm-hmm.
So the whole script and the trajectory of our narrative sort of leads up to that, to seeing some of that. You know, it kind of teases into it throughout the movie. So by the end, we see a little bit of that. It just seems to complete that part of the story. But that's the final unveiling of the ultimate truth. And if you see that, those images from far enough away, you know, like if you're the CEO of that company, you'll get our point that both the cows and, you know, our lead actress, Catalina, are, you know, they're kind of equally vulnerable, equally expendable. You know, there's not much difference between them, you know, on some level.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's kind of what we were getting at there. So, I mean, it's a little unsettling, but, you know, I haven't seen anybody walk out. It makes sense in the context of the movie.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but, you know, it's unsettling, but that, hey, you know, I think getting truth out on the table is a really good place to start, the full ramifications of, you know, what we're asked to buy, and then you can start, you know, dealing with the issues, but you got to know the truth first, or at least acknowledge it. Hopefully it's one thing to know the truth in your head, but it's another to have a human connection to it, and that's why I think a fictional film helps that way, because you can actually see it from the character's perspective in a way you wouldn't if someone was just telling you about it or showing you stock footage or something. This is like, it's real. It's more human, you know. It's like,
mm-hmm,
but there's a reason they keep this footage and these facts away from us. It's
right.
The same way our government keeps, you know, we're not supposed to see flag-draped coffins coming back from Iraq. We're not supposed to see grieving parents. We're not supposed to know all this stuff. Because once you make a human connection, you might question everything behind it, you know. So let's all stay disconnected from the truth, and, you know, the status quo can prevail pretty easily that way.
Well, staying with that theme, there is a scene in the film where some college kids are planning something pretty radical to try to bring about some change, and one of the characters says, the most patriotic thing I can think of doing right now is to defy the Patriot Act. And I read an interview with you where you said that you know, that line is one where it's not really the movie talking, it's something a hyped up college kid would say. And I love that because I had that exact same reaction to it, where I never really felt like that was Richard Linklater or Eric Schlosser talking to me, and being, they were just being conduits for you. How did you kind of pull that off where you're able to be political and be in your face and never really be preachy?
I hope so. That was our goal, to like no character would ever say anything that the character wouldn't really say. We didn't want to feel like, oh, here's the author's talking, or here's the film's political view. Where, you know, it would have been untruthful to have Wilmer in such a short amount of time organizing the union at the meatpacking plant, leading a march to the headquarters. And, you know, we tried to stay within the character reality. And when Amber, you know, the teenage girl, falls in with these kind of would-be college activists, you know, they're talking, but that's just, you know, that's teen, it's young people hanging out in their dorms and talking and stuff, which is an exciting time, you know, in her life.
Yeah.
But, strangely, this very week, what they kind of prophesized in the movie that we wrote a while back and, you know, filmed a year ago, has just came to pass in the Congress this week. There's a new act got through with absolutely no dissent, called the Animal Enterprise Terrorist Act. Terrorism Act.
Uh-huh.
And so they very successfully, now it's on in law, it passed through. So this kind of activism,
yeah,
if you do animal activism, you're now technically a terrorist.
Nice.
How about that?
Mm-hmm.
Domestic terrorists who are on record of never hurting another person, just like we say in the movie, are now subject to some really incredible, fines and incarceration and everything, just like they're, you know, plotting the over. So unbelievable, mm-hmm. but that shows you the strength of corporations and how they own our government, you know, that they can push something like that through.
Well, you've always explored working class characters and kind of working class themes, but you've made two movies this year now with A Scanner Darkly that are very overtly political in nature, and both end pretty bleakly. I don't think I'm giving anything away, where you kind of, you get to the end and the characters in the film, and I think by extension the audience, end up feeling really small, like really kind of helpless cogs in a much larger system. Is this a shift for you in terms of kind of what you're exploring as a director?
I think these films, just the fact that they just kind of reflect the times. So, you know, times are kind of bad. You know, movies reflect that in a way.
Mm-hmm.
I think it puts it always back on the viewer to kind of see that. I'm always exhilarated when someone can tell the truth and kind of take you down there a little bit. It's like, wow, at least someone's expressing it. You can kind of, you know, have this cathartic experience and hopefully, you know, get something out there in a positive way. I think it's positive. So, I don't know. They both can be analyzed politically, but I haven't changed. I'm still the mm-hmm. same guy. I'm just lucky I'm getting to express some of this in movies finally.
Well, at best, this is going to be a really obvious question. At worst, it's going to trivialize your film. So I apologize in advance, but there were some scenes that I noticed in the film that I wonder if on some level were they there just to kind of tantalize your fans, your hardcore fans, because you see Ethan Hawke in a bar talking about, I was reading this study the other day, and, you know, the guy sitting around the fire at the college party, the characters in Mickey's talking about the paranoia of the cameras watching them. I mean, it immediately recalls, you know, your films and specific scenes from your films. Was that deliberate at all?
No. I mean, it must be me. It must be just stuff I'm interested in or how I talk. You know, that's, it's not like, oh, I reference this in another movie. Uh-huh. That'll mean something. It's really not that at all.
Okay.
Because I know it's just like, oh, that's just the way, you know, I guess I, certain things come out or my point of view.
Yeah.
You know, feeling, try to keep it diverse, but you kind of can't help.
No.
We're sort of stuck with ourselves, I guess.
I was feeling deja vu during those times, I guess, just a little bit.
That's only because you know the other films.
That's
true.
That's true. Thank you again very much for your time.
It was really good talking to you.
Thank you. Thrilled to have you on.
When Film Spotting returns, your chance at a free DVD in Massacre Theater and the new Bond, Shaken, Stirred, and Beaten. Stay with us.
Let's talk about old friends. Let's talk about anything but what's really going on. Let's talk about old friends. Let's talk about heroes. Let's talk about heroes. Strong men, wise men, some
I really like you. There's no chance we can ever be together?
Only if you could promise me you'll never die.
You know I can't promise that.
If you did that, I would make love to you right now.
I promise I will never die.
You're listening to Film Spotting on Chicago Public Radio with Sam Van Halgren. I'm Adam Kempinar. It's time for Massacre Theater, the part of the show where we absolutely destroy one of the greatest screenplays ever written.
With
maybe
relish,
not.
That's right.
Maybe not in this case.
Well, maybe not
one
in this
of the
case.
Greatest, but we love it anyway. And if you can identify the movie we're massacring, you get a shot at a free DVD.
Last week on the Film Spotting podcast, Adam and I massacred the scene you heard coming out of the break from Team America, World Police, a tie-in with last week's top five culture clash movies. Adam, reach into that Film Spotting hat and pick out this week's winner.
And the winner is Dean Dogger from Huntington Beach, California. Congratulations, Dean. Email feedback@filmspotting.net, and we'll set you up with the DVD of your choice.
I think your dialogue is beautiful. I really do. I love it.
Then why the hell don't you just stand still and say it instead of wandering all over the stage? You're supposed to be looking for your soul, not an ashtray.
It's time now for this week's edition of Massacre Theater. And Sam, it ties in with our top five we're going to get to in the next segment.
Rushes.
Adrenaline Rushes. It does tie in with James Bond, kind of the action scenes that you get in a James Bond film. Adrenaline Rushes. So think of movies that have some good action scenes and could get the blood flowing a little bit. And with that in mind, that's all you really need to know. Two-person scene here. Sam, you're playing the woman this time.
Of course, as always.
Of course, as always. And you started off, so I'm going to give you the action. And action.
It was a long cruise, was it, Sailor?
It was too long.
What'd you want to do? Just drop right down on the tile and go for it?
No. Actually, I had this counter in mind.
Great. That would be very, very comfortable, yeah.
It could be. Actually, I came in here to save you from making a big mistake with that older guy.
Really? So I could go on to a bigger one with a young guy like yourself?
Maybe.
And scene.
Or should I say, maybe? Okay. If you know what film we just massacred, send us an email, feedback@filmspotting.net. The winner will be selected randomly from all the correct entries and announced on the next episode of the Film Spotting podcast. To listen and to get official Massacre Theater rules, visit filmspotting.net.
I'm Mr. Arlington Beach, professional gambler, and you're Miss Stephanie Broadchester, here.
I am not.
You're going to have to trust me on this.
Oh, no, I don't.
We've been involved for quite a while. Hence the shared suite.
My family is strict Roman Catholic, so for appearances' sake, it'll be a two-bedroom suite.
I do hate it when religion comes between us.
That's Daniel Craig making his debut as James Bond in Casino Royale. And this is not only a new Bond, it's Bond new to his position. In a prologue filmed in black and white, we actually see Bond making the two kills that earn him his 00 status. Later in the film, we get the odd side of Bond driving through an exotic locale in a compact rental car. The new Bond isn't as smooth as his predecessors. He's more prone to mistakes. He's vulnerable. Everybody's talking about how different this Bond is. But Adam, I'll admit, I'm just not a Bond fanatic. In fact, I'll be honest, I don't think I've seen a Bond film since the much-reviled Timothy Dalton days of old in the late 80s. But before I get your opinion, Adam, let's hear from someone who does love Bond, listener Christopher Alan Smith. He writes, "Sometimes it's just this simple. Casino Royale is the best James Bond film ever. As a lifelong Bond fan, I can't believe I'm writing these words, but I must because they're true. I haven't seen an action movie I've enjoyed so much since The Matrix, or maybe even Raiders of the Lost Ark."
Wow, blasphemy.
This must be what fanboy heaven is like. That's Christopher Alan Smith. Adam, what did you think?
Well, I'm not going to put Casino Royale above The Matrix or Raiders of the Lost Ark, because I don't think Casino Royale is doing anything truly groundbreaking, like both of those films, arguably, could be said to have done from an action movie standpoint. But instead of other films, you know, copying it, Casino Royale is actually in a lot of ways just copying Christopher Nolan's Batman Begins from last summer by giving us this darker take on a familiar character and giving us the backstory. But even if Casino Royale isn't groundbreaking cinema, it is groundbreaking for the Bond franchise. And I have to say, Sam, That was more than enough for me to enjoy the hell out of this movie.
Wow.
I did. You have to start with Daniel Craig. He is an odd choice. He rankled a few people maybe when he got the job. But considering the previous Bonds and the Bond persona we've all come to know, Daniel Craig is different. But he absolutely pulls it off and pays off. He's a more believable, interesting, complex, vulnerable, all the things you said, Bond, which we need here in 2006 in order to go along with this franchise at all. And I recently saw Daniel Craig on Charlie Rose, and he talked about the need for Bond to be a professional, someone who's trained to kill, not just the suave man of mystery, and he pulls that off. And also, Daniel Craig wanted to sort of imbue him with this sense of fallibility. He wants the audience to believe on some level that, yes, even though you're watching James Bond and you know he's the hero and there are going to be more James Bond movies, you have to have a sense during some of those scenes that he is vulnerable, that he could die, that something could go wrong here. And you have the great scene in this film where he does come close to dying, where he's poisoned and he goes into cardiac arrest. Later, he's captured by the bad guy and he's tortured, and it's far more gruesome than we'd expect it to be, painful. His response to it is different than any other Bond before him would have responded. He's truly lucky to get out of it and survive, as opposed to all the other Bonds we've seen where they get tied up and they have some neat gadget to get them out of the situation. How he gets out of it here, like I said, is actually kind of blind luck on his part, and it actually makes sense in terms of the plot, who it is to come and get him. So I could go through a whole litany of ways this movie subverts the Bond genre, what came before it, and I'm sure I'll get into some of them. For me, this was a true surprise. I told you that the trailer looked great only for about 20 seconds, right. And then it turns into every other Bond film I've ever seen. It's not, save for one scene that is awful. It's the big action piece of the film, the third scene of the movie, the big action sequence where he chases this guy and they jump all over cranes and they just destroy everything. Other than that scene, which is brutal, it's not like every Bond film you've ever seen. It's really interesting. It's a good film. I enjoyed it.
All right. Well, I have to say, like I admitted, I'm not really big into the Bond franchise. Hadn't seen one in years. It actually surprised me to think of how many years it must have been since I'd last seen. I didn't see any of the Pierce Brosnan Bonds. And I was hoping when I sat down, again, I wasn't going into this thinking I would hate it anything. I had no preconceived notions. I mean, I was 15 when I last saw one. I couldn't possibly have any. And I think what I was hoping for, at least expecting, if I was expecting anything, it was to be reminded nostalgically in a way about what appealed to me back then, or at least to remind me of what it was like to watch them, or maybe why I gave up on them in some place. Like, why didn't I follow the Bond franchise when Pierce Brosnan picked it up? This film didn't do it for me. This film only reminded me of why it was so easy.
You were wrong to want that.
No, I don't think those were unfair expectations. I'm saying very generally, just it was going to remind me a little bit what it was like to just be caught up in that world, the world of James Bond.
Okay.
I think that's fair, and I think that's
but it's a completely different world by design, and it should be. We're a long ways away from
the living
daylights.
Yeah, but I don't think it is, and this is my problem, because I think, you know, we talked about, you made the point when we were talking about Marie Antoinette, and we talked about Marie Antoinette a little bit earlier this week on the podcast. Your point about what was surprising and nice about Marie Antoinette was that Sofia Coppola's film, the actors within it weren't acting like they were historical figures in some way. I can't help but say about James Bond that everybody in the film was acting like they were in a James Bond movie. And for me, that's not interesting.
I
because I just think that every scene existed in a vacuum where, you know, we have a couple scenes that should have some consequences. At one point late in the film, where there's this long and terminal poker scene and it has no suspense at all. And Eva Green, the Bond girl, although a different sort of Bond girl, I think it's fair to say, witnesses something that really shakes her up, and she has a breakdown of some kind.
Yeah.
And then the next scene or the rest of the film, you feel like that never had to happen. You feel like it was an effort on the filmmaker's part and the screenwriter's part, and I think they do this several times throughout the film, to make it deeper, more profound, to make it, I can't help but think of like the Bourne movies, the Bourne Supremacy, Bourne Identity, that at least made you rethink how you thought of Bond, because it was such a, in terms of, it made a real action hero in some way of Jason Bourne. And I feel like there were attempts to try to capture the energy of that. And for me, and again, I don't want to rain on anybody's parade, it really just didn't work for me. And it didn't work for me when they attempted to do those things either.
Well, it did work for me. I see what you're saying. It obviously did work for me. I think that I understand certainly what you say about the card scenes. it's not that interesting watching people playing cards. No. It's just not. Even when you know poker kind of blew up on TV and people got into Texas Hold'em, that was interesting for about a week, and then you know it really isn't that much fun. It isn't here. Unfortunately, one of our favorite actors, Jeffrey Wright,
is totally
wasted in the film as a guy who just sits there and is a really bad poker player, and it isn't. It's not remotely fascinating to watch. And I hated that first sequence that I mentioned, and those scenes that you talked about, some of the scenes with Vesper Lynd, the Bond girl, Ava Green, they don't work because they are overreaching. They are trying so hard to be new and be more profound and be more relevant in this complicated age that they overreach sometimes, and that scene doesn't work. In fact, it's almost laughable. And there are a few scenes like that where their love scenes, their love dialogue is a little bit laughable. However, I will say that I honestly felt like, as laughable as some of the dialogue was, Daniel Craig was so interesting, and the way he responded to her cheesy lines were so interesting that it made it okay. It sort of salvaged the bad dialogue for me. And I think that the stuff about the new Bond, they put enough new things in there to make it relevant, to make it interesting, and to just put a spin on it. Maybe as someone who, you know, Sam, someone who has not really watched a lot of Bond films at all, and I'm no expert by any means, but I've seen more than you. For me, just sort of watching the way they deconstruct the conventions of the Bond film was fascinating enough and fun for me. I mean, the fact that he orders his martini, doesn't ask for it shaken or stirred, he says, give it to me however, I don't care. We see him come out of the water looking buff in his swimsuit, not Ursula Andress or Halle Berry, which is really interesting. We could talk about that for a long time probably. Other than that one extended chase scene, there aren't any others that are really like that. In fact, there's You settle in. I found myself going, oh, he just got in his car to chase after the bad guys who have stolen the Bond girl, and they're going to have this big chase scene. I'm actually kind of settling in for it a little bit, and it's over. It's over in like 2 minutes.
Yeah.
That's interesting. They know that they're kind of playing with you a little bit here. The fact that, like I said, that Bond is fallible and imperfect. The first death scene, seeing James Bond get his hands dirty. He has to kill people a couple of times by strangling them. And it's ugly. This isn't Bond playing cricket and killing people nice and conveniently with his gun. This is dirty. And, too, the fact that Bond falls in love here, which fans of the franchise know that, of course, on Her Majesty's Secret Service, he does, and his wife dies and all that stuff. And this film sort of takes up where that film should have left off, and the franchise didn't go with it. I will just add one quick thing, too, that I have a friend, a former coworker, who is a huge Bond freak. And he went and saw this film and actually loved it so much that it shamed him in a way for liking other Bond films. Wow. He thinks it's that good that it makes all these other Bond films look really pretty pale by comparison, and I think he's right. I had a lot of fun with it.
All right. I'm glad you did. I have to say, too, I mean, we don't want to get into it, but the whole structure of it in terms of how the villains work, I mean, a practical question about the film. I mean, there were so many layers and, like, where people are revealed to not be who they think they are.
Sure.
There was no real honest-to-God villain in this film
either. No, and you know what? And I loved that about it because I thought about this, that in 2006, if you think about it, these days of having the one big villain, there's one evil guy in the world that's bent on destroying everything.
And he wants $1 million.
Exactly. And Bond's going to stop him, and the world is a happy place until the other megalomaniac comes along.
Yes.
That's not the way the world works. The fact is, whether it's Osama bin Laden or whoever you want to throw out there, they die. There's another one just like them out there waiting
to
take his spot.
There's a money man.
Exactly. There's someone always behind something more sinister. I think that was just another thing the movie got right. I can't believe they were able to take Bond and make it relevant and vital. And Daniel Craig is incredible in this film.
I wonder if I saw a different Bond film.
Maybe. Different print of it. Maybe.
maybe it was.
You didn't see it with the good audience I saw it
That's true.
In Norfolk, Virginia last weekend
point.
Where the audience clapped when the film was over.
Wow.
They did. And I understood. I felt their applause, Sam.
All right. Well, if you've seen Casino Royale, we want to know what you think. Send us an email, feedback@filmspotting.net.
It's time for one last quick break, and when we come back, do you really think you have a chance against us, Mr. Cowboy? Sam and I say yippee-ki-yay and reveal our top five adrenaline rushes next. Stay with us.
Chloe was a neighbor girl, walked around in a trance. Loud nights, this is basic, get that homecoming dance. Father was religious, mother was too. She yearned to be a model, had issues with food. Last I heard of Chloe, someone saw her on TV. Preaching the power of hypnosis and aroma therapy. Dobby was my sister's friend, a fashion paranoid. She wore a winter coat all summer long, made a lot of noise. Conservatives and demagogues, and how was she?
Okay, you're giving her an injection of adrenaline straight to her heart, but she's got a breastplate, so you gotta pierce through that. So what you gotta do is you gotta bring the needle down in a stabbing motion.
Welcome back to Film Spotting on Chicago Public Radio with Adam Kempinar. I'm Sam Van Halgren. We want to take a minute to thank Chuck Prophet for today's music. The songs you're hearing are from his albums No Other Love and Age of America.
That's right. San Francisco-based Chuck Prophet. Great stuff from him. It's time for our top five, Sam. And we heard, coming out of the break there, of course, the adrenaline scene, Uma Thurman, John Travolta from Pulp Fiction. We're going to follow their lead and get into some of our favorite scenes that pump us up, for lack of a better phrase, that get us excited, get the blood flowing a little bit. And we're kind of pretentious film snobs a little bit. We can cop to that just a little bit. So we don't spend a lot of time talking about action movies or action scenes.
And
so
we don't talk about guilty pleasures a lot. I did feel like this sort of fell into that category better than anything else we've ever covered in the history of the show. Where I was just talking about visceral feeling I had about, you know, watching a film. It shocked me. It gave me that shot of adrenaline.
Yeah, and so, again, we're going for that kind of shot of adrenaline. It isn't necessarily movies that inspired us, where you get chills, and it also isn't moments that necessarily disturb you. For example, I know a listener wrote in and said, Requiem for a Dream.
Right.
You know, everything about the last 20 minutes of that film. Well, I'll agree. There's nothing maybe more upsetting in cinema than the last 20 minutes of Requiem for a Dream, and it does have me on edge and on the edge of my seat, but in a different way.
Absolutely.
Okay, so with that in mind, let's get started, Sam. You're number five.
All right, and I did eliminate sports films as well because, again, I think that falls under the category of inspirational, but I have to say, when I thought of the scenes that get my blood pumping, I immediately thought of a scene that is not in any film, at least not in any film yet, and it is watching the 2004 World Series DVD, Red Sox versus Yankees Game 4 in Fenway Park.
Dave Roberts
steals second. The history of Red Sox Nation changed forever. That's the scene I'm going to watch.
Okay.
But getting to my top five, I actually start with, we were talking about the fact that we weren't pretentious film snobs. I'm starting my list with October 25th. 1415, St. Crispin's Day speech.
You're
Kenneth
totally
Branagh,
proving me wrong. We are snobs. Fifth.
I think the rest of mine, I'll be acquitted of film snobbery. But I was thinking about scenes, and I thought it would be more of a nostalgic list, that scenes would immediately come to me. But I had to go through a huge list of films, and this scene came to me, where it's his speech, his famous St. Crispin's Day speech, followed by the Battle of Agincourt. And it's like a 10-minute sequence, brilliantly scored, and it works for me.
Okay. Gets the blood flowing, so to speak. All right. Well, my number five, Sam, I know is a film that I'll be surprised if you leave out of your top five, and that is we shared this memory. This is one of the first films where we ever remember being a kid, being in the theater, watching a film, and being on the edge of our seat, nervous about a film. And it is, for me, The Hunt for Red October, with the great Alec Baldwin in the Jack Ryan role that Harrison Ford later played. And I have to admit, it's been too long since I've seen the movie to remember all of the details, but basically the sub showdown at the end of the film, that's the climax of the film, with the torpedoes just missing the sub, and them also having to disguise what they were doing to make the Russians think that, you know, the Red October has been destroyed, that all just adds kind of an extra layer of interest to it. And again, I remember seeing it, I think when I was maybe fourth grade or fifth grade, in the theater with a friend, and during that scene at the end, I was so nervous and on the edge of my seat, and I remember walking out thinking, wow, I've never been that nervous about a movie before.
I absolutely had the exact same response. It's not on my list only because I did, in preparation for this list, I went and watched the last bit of Hunt for Red October.
And it didn't work as well?
And instead, I was just like, what is Sean Connery doing with a Scottish accent? He's supposed to be Russian.
you film snob.
I'm such a film snob. But I was trying to find that moment, and I couldn't find it, so I did take it off the list.
Okay.
So my number four, if you're looking for the scene on the DVD, it's called Lobby Shooting Spree. It's The Matrix. This is the scene when I got my entertainment system, my surround sound. This is the DVD I put in. This is the scene I played Neo and Trinity unload about 1,000 rounds of ammunition in this building's lobby, frequently defy gravity, mowing down heavily armed security forces on their way to rescue Lawrence Fishburne. It's a scene that, taken out of context, works. Adrenaline rush.
Okay, gets you excited. Well, it's not one of my favorite scenes, as I've told you before, Sam,
you
in The Matrix, but there are a lot of moments in The Matrix that could work. My number four, I've got a war movie tie here. I've got Full Metal Jacket. Believe it or not, the opening scene of Full Metal Jacket, Arlie Ermey is the drill sergeant indoctrinating the Marines to boot camp. It's this vicious verbal assault that I remember seeing it as a young kid kind of laughing at, because I think it was too shocking in a way, the brutality of it. I thought it was funny at the time, but also really terrifying. And he has you so on edge and so terrified, just like the men are, that it gets your blood flowing. But also, Saving Private Ryan, a film that I've said before on the show, I think is a little bit overrated. I think it's really flawed. But that D-Day sequence, from the sound design, the cinematography, the graphic nature of it, you just want the battle to stop the second it starts.
Yeah, that's a great pick. All right, my number three, one of our favorite films from last year, Park Chan-wook's Old Boy. The scene I'm thinking of in particular, just to give you a bit of a background here, Oh Dae-soo, he's a 30-something husband and father, mysteriously and inexplicably imprisoned in a hotel room for 15 years. When he's finally released, he has 5 days to find out who's responsible and to exact his revenge. And the scene I'm thinking of, he's at the end of a hallway. At the other end of the hallway is an elevator door he has to get to. In his way, about 30 thugs. In one long, unbroken scene, he plows through all of these, getting the crap beaten out of him. But the way it's scored, there's just like this urgency with the way he does it. It's slow. It's not the typical action, fast-cutting scenes you get. But the way he really deliberately moves through these 30 thugs, and then he gets to the elevator door. The door's open. The camera is on Oh Dae-soo's face. He breaks into this huge grin. We cut inside the elevator door, and it's packed full of another 15 thugs. It's just an amazing scene. I did watch it again last night just to make sure it works, and it
and
absolutely
it did?
Does.
Okay. Well, my number three, I'm going with William Friedkin's The French Connection. I think everyone agrees that the car chase scene in this film with Gene Hackman is one of the greatest in film history, and for me, I would certainly put it right up at the top. And it was filmed in Bensonhurst, Brooklyn, running down the old B subway line. It's an elevated track. And what's interesting about it is that a lot of the scenes, from what I've read about it, were real. And you get that sense watching it, that there was a stuntman driving, and Friedkin's actually in the back seat with a camera. He's like wrapped in carpet or something, trying to protect himself. And the way they set it up, why it ends up being so urgent and so scary in a way that you think, you know, he's about to wreck more than any other kind of conventional action scene, is because they had all these wrecks staged that other stunt drivers were supposed to just narrowly miss the driver, except they didn't. And actually, they were doing this. They had a siren, but people didn't know. They weren't on like a closed track here. It was in Bensonhurst, and they just did it. And they had these drivers who were supposed to miss them, and they didn't miss sometimes. So it's a really fascinating scene to watch, especially when you know that. And it is one of those kind of really blood-pumping moments where you just watch Gene Hackman just so determined to get this guy that he's after that he just drives the car with complete reckless abandon.
Great pick. All right, I'm going to segue here. Perfect segue, actually. Thank you for mentioning Gene Hackman. I'm going to go to this. I'm going to play a clip here.
You beat William Money out of Missouri. Killed women and children.
That's right. I've killed women and children. Killed just about everything that walks or crawls at one time or another. And I'm here to kill you, little Bill.
And that is the final shootout at the end of Unforgiven, which is at once thrilling and completely devastating as you get Clint Eastwood's character sort of reemerge as his old self, the man who killed women and children. And it's a quick, again, I checked these scenes out before putting this list together, and it's such a short scene. But certainly the stakes that he introduces right at the top, I'm here to kill you, little Bill, and just the quick way that whole thing is executed, and then him sort of walking across to the bar and pouring that glass of whiskey that really means that the old life that he put behind him has returned. That scene totally works for me, absolutely.
Great scene. My number two, I'm going with the film we do both love. You mentioned it during Casino Royale, and it's a better film than Casino Royale. It is The Bourne Identity, and it's not the big car chase, which is very good, but it's the scene with Clive Owen, one of our favorite actors, the showdown with the professor, as he's known. The tension in that scene, where he has to go out, he realizes someone's there to kill him, he goes out into this wooded area to try to track him down. Because of the quiet of it, because it's so opposite from what we're used to with an action movie, from an action movie showdown, because he has to get away, and it isn't this, again, as I said, huge set piece, but you're focused simply on the one-to-one nature of it. The fact that one of them is going to die, and they're going to see the person they're killing. It isn't just someone mowing down someone with, you know, a stream of bullets, and they have to do it at close range. But again, it comes back to the tension of it. It's such a quiet scene. You don't know where the guy is that he's after. I love that scene. It makes that whole film for me. It just elevates a film I already loved. It makes it even better.
I love that scene, too. And I can't believe, and I know people are going to be furious. You know, you will not hear John Woo at my number
one.
You probably won't hear it at the top of your list
even
either.
Even though I like those films.
I do,
Hard
absolutely.
Boiled, The Killer.
But if you're waiting, my number one surprised me, too. And again, I watched all of these scenes. That's how I ranked them. This one, surprisingly, yes, entered at number one. It is
Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs.
Snow White and the Seven... No, it is Stagecoach. John Ford. The scene where the stagecoach is surrounded by Geronimo and the Apaches. And you just watch this scene. This film came out in 1939. And yes, part of it is the sound, the movement, the sheer velocity of, or at least the velocity that John Ford captures of the stagecoach and the horses. There's something so elemental about hearing horses, you know, gallop furiously across a plain that just literally gets your blood pumping. And just the way the whole thing is executed with the stuntman, John Wayne's stuntman, like climbing up on the, you know, from horse to horse to horse to get to the front. You know, just, it's incredible. So again, it lands at number one, surprisingly. Yes, it's 70 years old, but it still makes it.
Well, how's this for symmetry, Sam? You go for your number one with a movie that started off our first ever marathon on Film Spotting, the Westerns. I'm going with a movie that closed out that very same Westerns marathon, and it's going to surprise you. And let's go ahead and hear a clip from this film.
You made a fool of yourself and this railroad in the bargain. Now, I want you to apologize to this. Yes, sir, can I help you? If they move, kill them.
There's no way you can get the full effect of that scene, but it is the opening scene from The Wild Bunch, a film, Sam, you famously got wrong in your review. The freeze frame credits, the music you hear there, the martial music, the juxtaposition with the scorpions the kids are torturing, and the brutality of the gunfight we're about to see. It's really hard to watch.
I loved that first scene.
I'm sure you did.
It was the rest of it that was sadistic.
The innocent bystanders being mowed down, women and children. It really does take your breath away, that entire extended opening massacre, and it is a massacre. But literally, it's just Peckinpah's editing and what he shoots and the way he shoots it. It's the juxtaposition of those scenes. It's the music, the freeze framing. Get you ready to go out and shoot someone. That's all I got to say.
I won't fight you now, but we're just going to have to end it.
Okay.
That is our top five. Please send your top five or any other feedback to feedback@filmspotting.net or give us a call at 206-203-2463 and leave a message. We'll be back next month with another top five and more reviews of new and recently released movies right here on Chicago Public Radio. In the meantime, go to filmspotting.net to listen to the weekly Film Spotting podcast.
I was just kidding about the guns thing. It actually just makes me want to ride a horse really badly. So,
well done.
Yeah.
Good save.
Okay. Next week on the podcast, Sam and I review Darren Aronofsky's time-jumping love story, The Fountain, and we'll continue our latest marathon, our animation marathon, with Takahata's Grave of the Fireflies.
Just opening last night in Chicago for a week's run at the Gene Siskel Film Center, Stanley Nelson's acclaimed new documentary, Jonestown, The Life and Death of People's Temple. You can find our review on the Film Spotting site, filmspotting.net. You can also visit filmspotting.net for complete show archives, a calendar of upcoming reviews, and more.
This radio edition of Film Spotting is presented by Chicago Public Radio with editorial and production assistance from Christina Stevens and Joe Dassault. Our thanks again to Chuck Prophet for today's music. Thanks also to Richard Linklater and Fox Searchlight Pictures. For Film Spotting, I'm Adam Kempinar.
And I'm Sam Van Halgren. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.
Film Spotting is presented by PeerFlix, the online DVD exchange. Learn more at peerflix.com/filmspotting.
Game four of the Yankees versus Red Sox. Tony Roberts, steal a second. That changed the history of the Red Sox nation.
His name is actually Dave Roberts.
Dave Roberts,
Mr. Red Sox fan. No, we're keeping that in. I'm shaming you on air, Mr. Boston Red Sox.
I've got to do it again.
Well, at least we have an outtake.
What did I say? Tony Roberts?
Tony Roberts.
Who the hell's that?
Is it Tony Robbins? The self-help guy? Okay, so start again.
Fuck, from where? Shit.